So we're going to start a new series, and if you know anything about me, you know that as a preacher, I'm what is called an expository preacher. I like to take us into books of the Bible and work through the book of the Bible, and I love to couple books of the Bible with a theme of sorts. So this theme is going to be called The Art of Neighboring, and I'm actually stealing that title from a book that I'm going to be challenging everyone in the month of May to read together. Now, I know a couple of you are like, okay, Rob, I'm not a reader. You keep saying read books. I don't like to read books. So here's a couple of pieces of advice, all right? You ready? Number one, there is this incredible program called Audibles. You know about that? All right, if you're not a reader, you can download Audibles. You can get the book and listen to it. If you're like, I'm not tech savvy, well, then hope you have a really good friend that will read the book to you, okay? Personally, I wasn't always a reader. When I was growing up in grade school and even high school, I often, to be honest, went online and downloaded the Cliff Notes for my book reports, okay? But when I got to seminary, I started adopting this as a habit, and it has just helped me so much to learn, because when you read good books, you get to stand on the shoulders of others. This book begins with a provocative question. They ask this question: what if the solution to our society's biggest issues has been right under our noses for the past 2,000 years? Now, here's a question that I think is really important to ask right now. Number one, when you get outside and you talk to people, would you agree with me that people are genuinely concerned about the state of the world, about the country, about their personal lives? Do you hear a lot of concern in people's voices, like anxious statements, fearful statements? Do you guys hear that too? I do. All the time. And, you know, you're hearing all kind of solutions offered about these problems. Well, if we just vote in so-and-so, or if we just, you know, took the money and we threw it in this direction, or if we just started this program, well, that would solve the problem. But here's the question: what if the solution, the most impactful solution, is not the ballot box, is not more money, is not just another program? What if it is doing what the Bible has told us to do for thousands of years? Now, here's the summary statement of what God's will for your life is in kind of two expressed commands. Command number one is love God. Command number two is love your neighbor as yourself. You know, I've been around Christians my entire life, and when you go up to a Christian and you say, well, what are the two great commandments from the Bible? We can just like spout this off rote from memory. Hey guys, what's the greatest command? Love God, love others. We got it. We know that. But I'll tell you, the problem is that we've turned these types of things into more of a metaphor. Like the word neighbor, for example. Who's my neighbor? Well, my neighbor is everybody. I love everyone. But I like this kind of thought when it comes to treating love like that. We make love so broad that no one seems to benefit from our love. Or you could say it like this: when you aim for everybody, often we end up being neighbors with nobody. There's 8 billion people in the world. Last time I checked, you can't solve all of their problems. You know why? Here's a newsflash: you're not God. You can't take care of all those problems. But what if we started getting better at knowing the people that are actually in our lives, like as in our next door neighbors, as in our immediate family, an extended family, and our church family, and our own community? What if we got so good at that, at loving these people? I think the book of Ruth is a great book at helping us understand how to do this. It is laden with principles. It's one of my favorite books of the Bible, in fact. You know, some of the principles that we're going to walk through as we go through this book, here's the first one. I found this in the life of Naomi. If I'm emotionally and spiritually unhealthy, I'm not going to be effective at loving others. As you look at Naomi's story, her name means pleasant, but in the end of chapter one, she says, no, don't call me pleasant anymore. Call me Mara. Do you know what that name means in Hebrew? Bitter. And in the first service, we had Mara Evans with us, and I said to the church, I was like, now that's the Hebrew name for Mara. The Greek name for Mara is, get this, eternally beautiful. And that's true of Mara Evans. But Naomi, she's not doing well. We're going to learn as we look at Ruth that really neighboring is about the commitments that I make to the people that God has placed in my life. As we look at Boaz, we're going to see that generosity is more than just kind of random acts of kindness, but it's including many underneath my umbrella of care. And here's the thing about Ruth. You can't get through Ruth without appreciating the love story. So another principle that we're going to see about neighboring is actually with Ruth and Boaz. Their love story is not a contained love story, but they live out their love story virtuously, and that enfolds others into the blessing of their love. And then finally, the principle that we're going to end with is that if you really want to be a good neighbor, you have to be, get this, greedy. Yes, greedy for the long term, greedy for legacy, greedy for seeing God take the day-to-day right choices that you're making, the choice to love others well, the choice to live a life of character, and seeing him create a legacy through that. As we look at Ruth, we're going to see that there is this incredible foreshadowing of Jesus. Because Ruth and Boaz do the right things, we end up having a Messiah on planet Earth and a means to achieving salvation through this Messiah. Praise God for that. So I'm excited about this book. I think this is a wild ride. So get ready, buckle up, and let's get going. Now, as we begin this story is like many stories. It does not begin with a happy beginning, okay? I love the Bible because the Bible is real. It doesn't paint the world to us through a set of rose-colored glasses. Eugene Peterson said it like this of the Bible: no literature is more realistic and honest in facing the harsh facts of life than the Bible. At no time is there the faintest suggestion that the life of faith exempts us from difficulties. On every page of the Bible, there is recognition that faith encounters troubles. Now, we saw that the last couple of weeks, if you were with us. Harry was walking us through Psalm 139, and I thought those were such powerful sermons because they were instructing us on how you navigate pain and suffering in this world. And I gotta say, people need a roadmap for that. It's not easy. As you look at Ruth, especially Naomi, we get another roadmap for that. Let me read about her story, the first couple of verses, verses 1-5. In the days when the judges ruled in Israel, a severe famine came upon the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, taking his wife and two sons with him. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife was Naomi. Their two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in the land of Judah. And when they reached Moab, they settled there. Then Elimelech died, and Naomi was left with her two sons. The two sons married Moabite women. One married a woman named Orpah, the other a woman named Ruth. But after 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion died. This left Naomi alone without her two sons, for her husband. Now, as I'm looking through these first five verses, I'm noticing a couple of things. The first thing I'm noticing is the power of choice. If you look at this story, one choice leads to another choice, leads to another choice, leads to another choice. Look at the verse 1, and you'll notice the time period we're in. The days when the judges ruled in Israel. If you know your Old Testament, you know the story of the book of Judges. If you've never read that story before, you should go and read it. Now, it is a wild story. You get to the end of the book of Judges and you think to yourself, what did I just read? Like, what happened here? But that's the point. The summary statement of society in the book of Judges is, in that day, Israel had no king, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Let me just say this. We value autonomy and individualism as Westerners, but it gets really, really, really bad when someone thinks what is really, really right for them is really, really wrong for someone else. And of course, that's called anarchy. And that's what we were living with in the book of Judges. Now, that's a choice. That's a choice that a culture makes. We get to smaller choices. We get to the choice of one family. Elimelech, whose name means my God is king, is from Bethlehem, which that name means house of bread. Now, here's an irony that we already pick up on in the story. Elimelech leaves house of bread, which means it's the breadbasket of Judah. They're producing so much surplus that they're exporting bread to other areas in the region. He's leaving it because of a famine. Why is there a famine? Well, we're told earlier in the Old Testament that God would bless his people with bread if they were faithful to him. And God would send things like famine and oppressors and other issues if they were not faithful to him. So Bethlehem is under God's judgment. And Elimelech chooses to kind of flee that judgment and go into the land of Moab, expressly forbidden by God. And that choice results into a series of tragedies. You see it again in the names. My God is king, ironically, doesn't trust God as king. He leaves the land, and he has two sons whose names are Mahlon and Chilion. Now, here's the meaning of names in the Hebrew. Names tell us something about a person. You understand something basic about that person when you hear their name. So Mahlon means sickly. Chilion means crybaby. Can you imagine, like, your parents hold you for the first time and they're like, here's sicko and here's crybaby. But you know, this is all telling us what's happening behind the scenes. Hunger pangs, frailty, malnourishment. Elimelech, after this move, he ends up dying. And then there's more choices. Mahlon and Chilion, they don't have opportunity to take, you know, Bethlehemite girls out on dates. So they start taking Moabite women out on dates. They end up marrying two Moabite women, expressly forbidden again in God's law. They end up losing their lives. Naomi is left bereft. Now, this is a series about neighboring, and one thing that I want to observe as we go through this book is principles on neighboring, and I want to suggest one principle that is already emerging on this idea of neighboring is that self-preservation is the antithesis of neighboring. In other words, when I make decisions to purely benefit myself and I exclude other people in the equation as I'm making my decisions, I'm not going to be a good neighbor. What is self-preservation? Well, it's the choice to circle the wagons around myself, me and my own. And that's what Elimelech's doing. There's famine in Bethlehem. What if he chose to stay? What if he chose to lend a hand to people? What if he trusted God as king with that situation? Would we be in this predicament? I don't think so. And I think that the result of self-preservation that we see in this story and also in the real world is both isolation and the compounding of my problems. I felt like just a few years ago in 2020, we kind of watched many people go into self-preservation mode during the pandemic. I remember the first 2 weeks or so when things were really starting to kind of come out as new information, there was a fear that the supply chain was breaking down. You remember going to the grocery stores and seeing the shelves like this? Do you remember how toilet paper became worth its weight in gold? Friends, what is that? That's self-preservation. And I believe that moments like that are actually opportunities to shine forth this mandate from God to be a good neighbor. I love Joyce Hassinger's story. Joyce was at a grocery store, and she was kind of getting her things for her grocery cart, and she came across a mother who was just torn up, frantic, frenetic, even kind of a little grousey towards her. And she came to find out that the mom was freaking out because she didn't have any toilet paper, and she couldn't find any toilet paper, and she didn't know what she was going to do. So Joyce checked out, and she was driving home and just kind of praying to God and thinking about this woman and feeling empathy for her and saying, Lord, what can I do about this? I feel badly for her. She's just all tied up in knots. And when she got home, it was like the Lord just put it on her heart, like, Joyce, you got some extra boxes of toilet paper. Why don't you grab one of those and take it back to that woman? And if you guys know Joyce Hassinger, you know that when she feels like God says do something, she does it. So she gets this box of toilet paper. She goes back to the store. She hands it to this woman, and she says, I'm doing this because I love Jesus. I'll tell you, that's incredible. That's neighboring versus self-preservation. Now, let's keep going through this story, because we got to get into Naomi's story. She's a key character in the story. And Naomi, as you can tell, is not in a good place right now, right? I think we can all agree on that. You don't need a degree in psychology to discern why. She has lost everything. She's lost her husband. She's lost her 2 sons. She's lost her reputation. She's lost her security. In this culture, when a woman became a widow and she lost her sons as well, it was like a death sentence was hanging over her head. So Naomi has been going through this period of her life, and we kind of read it as 5 verses. We think it's just boom, 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 but this is 10 years of her life. I don't know about you, but I struggle when I have a bad week, let alone a bad year. But a bad 10 years will warp your soul. And Naomi has this cloud of bitterness hanging over her. Let's read it. It says, then Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had blessed his people in Judah by giving them good crops again. So Naomi and her daughters-in-law got ready to leave Moab to return to her homeland. With her 2 daughters-in-law, she set out from the place where she had been living, and they took the road that would lead them back to Judah. But on the way, Naomi said to her 2 daughters-in-law, go back to your mother's homes. And may the Lord reward you for your kindness to your husbands and to me. May the Lord bless you with the security of another marriage. Then she kissed them goodbye, and they all broke down and wept. No, they said, we want to go with you to your people. But Naomi replied, why should you go on with me? Can I still give birth to other sons who could grow up to be your husbands? No, my daughters. Return to your parents' homes, for I am too old to marry again. And even if it were possible and I were to get married tonight and bear sons, then what? Would you wait for them to grow up and refuse to marry someone else? No, of course not, my daughters. Things are far more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord himself has raised his fist against me. And again, they wept together. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung tightly to Naomi. Look, Naomi said to her, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. You should do the same. When you think about that word neighbor, how would you define it? Remember, it's this idea, right? My grand purpose in life is to love God and to love my neighbor as myself. So I would put all of that together in a sentence like this. Neighboring is loving the people God has placed in our lives for his glory. The people God's placed in your life for his glory. When you look at that definition and you look at the way that Naomi is relating towards Orpah and Ruth right now, would you say she's fulfilling that mandate? And my answer is, I don't think so. I think that the truth is that if my soul's not doing well, I'm not going to neighbor well. I'm not going to be able to fulfill the mandate that God has for my life. Now, in her case, Naomi kind of names what it is. She calls herself bitter. She's dealing with bitterness. What is bitterness? Well, it's deep anger and frustration and disappointment at life. I'll tell you, I have been talking to people about their concerns for many, many years, and bitterness is a problem for many people. There are people who have this kind of roadblock when it comes to shining forth the light of Christ, when it comes to loving others well. And the roadblock, of course, is bitterness. It is unresolved anger. You'll sit down and talk with one of these people about their issue, their concern, the event that took place. And as you listen to them process their life, whatever happened, say it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago sometimes, it is as if it had happened yesterday. And here's another thing. They're madder about it today than they were then. It just keeps compounding. So how are you supposed to love your neighbor as yourself when you're dealing with bitterness? And here's what bitterness does to us beyond that. I see three things with Naomi. The first thing is it turned her into a practical atheist. You know what that is? That's a person who perhaps shows up to church on Sundays and they can say things about God, and maybe they even know the Sunday school answers to the biblical questions. But when push comes to shove with the choices and the decisions that they're making with their life, it's as if God is not a factor. I see this with Naomi's reason for returning back to Bethlehem. She says that she's heard that the Lord has blessed Bethlehem with bread. But one commentator observed this, and I think he's spot on. The reason that she's returning is not for the blessing, it's for the bread. In other words, I don't think I stand a chance in Moab. I don't think these people are going to extend benevolence to me, but I know that if I go home, they'll care about me. Now, one of the beautiful things about God is God can sometimes take our poorly motivated decisions and create grace and blessing as a result of those. Another thing about bitterness is it can turn us into a black hole. What is a black hole? It's a gravity well. When you think about the definition of neighboring, if it's for me to love the people that God's placed in my life, for the glory of God, it means that I am supposed to be a reflective body, that as people look at my life, they see the love and hope and the compassion of Christ in and through me. It's compelling. But black holes, they don't reflect. They suck everything in. You meet a person like this, you find out that they're a Christian, and you're like, I don't know. That doesn't sound appealing to follow the Lord. They turn into pragmatists. They turn cynical. For them, the glass is not only half empty, but they believe that the water in the glass is actually poisoned. Naomi, in verses 12 to 13, you hear her become a black hole. Why should you go on with me? Can I still give birth to other sons who could grow up to be your husbands? No, my daughters, return to your parents' homes, for I am too old to marry again. And even if it were possible and I were to get married tonight and bear sons, then what? What, would you wait for them to grow up? Would you refuse to marry? A bitter well can only give bitter water. And it might even seem like, and I think actually at the motivational level that Naomi cares about Ruth and Orpah in her way, she really does. I think she loves them. But her advice is flawed. Her logic is flawed. Do whatever is good for you. I hope that your God treats you better than my God has treated me. Is that reflecting the glory of God to anyone? Of course it's not. And she's telling them to go back to their God. Do you know who their God was? His name was Chemosh. The name, most scholars believe, means destroyer. He was represented as a fish god, and a central feature of Chemosh worship was the sacrifice of children. Naomi, what are you doing? How could you suggest something like that to another person, let alone your daughters-in-law? Well, here's the thing. Bitterness often is a result of you losing confidence in God. And if you lose confidence in God, you will give people really bad advice. You won't direct them to the Lord, even if the alternative is really bad. You know, anytime I direct a person away from Christ in this culture and in any way, shape, or form, I'm directing them into the kingdom of Satan, into darkness, into corruption. But here's the deepest root of Naomi's problem. She's angry with God. Look at verse 13. Things are far more bitter for me than you, because the Lord himself has raised his fist against me. Let me paraphrase that for you. All of the things that have happened for the last 10 years are God's fault. He's the problem. He did this to me. I have a book on my shelf. I recommend it all the time. I commend it to you now. The name of the book is Anger. It's written by Gary Chapman. I think that a lot of people need to read books on anger because I think there's a lot of unresolved anger that people deal with today. One of the chapters in the book is, what do I do when I'm angry at God? He talks about a woman as he's beginning the chapter. Her name's Diane, and she's coming to his counseling office. She has just gone through one of the worst tragedies a human being could experience in her life. It's 3 months fresh. Her daughter, Jennifer, was killed by a drunken driver. And Diane is raging inside. She is mad at the world. She's mad at everyone. She hates the drunken driver. She is so angry at the judicial system because this guy had 3 DUIs and he's on the road again. She is raging at her ex-husband because he bought her that little car. And if she had been in a better car, not that little car, then she'd still be alive today. Now, Chapman is a wise counselor. He understands that Diane is a committed Christian, and he knows that there's a deeper root to this problem. And he says, how do you feel towards God right now? And she says, to be honest with you, I'm mad at him. How could he? How could he let this happen to my Jennifer? She was such a beautiful, wonderful person. She didn't do anything to anyone. How could God do this? Now, Chapman says this about anger, especially if you're a person of faith. He says, number one, anger and grief, they're often companions. When you go through something deep and tragic, anger will often come along with that. And he goes on to say this, it is often true that the stronger one's Christian commitment, the more intense will be the person's anger towards God. So how am I supposed to be that neighbor that God's calling to be if I'm mad at him? And here's an even bigger question. Is it wrong for me to be mad at God? In other words, is it sinful? I think scripture gives us three steps we can take if we find ourselves here. The first step, if you're feeling anger towards God, is, well, even before this, is you got to admit it to yourself. But then once you acknowledge it, you got to take it to him. The thing with anger is it is an emotion that God created. It's not sinful, but it is sinful to do something sinful because I'm angry. Paul says that in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26, doesn't he? He says, what? Be angry and do not sin. So if you feel anger, don't do the wrong thing as a result. And if I'm going to paraphrase it in this context, when you're feeling angry with God, do not sin. Now, if you know the story of Job, Job's wife was telling Job to sin. She says, go ahead and curse God and die. Let me just let you in on a little secret here. That's a really bad idea. Don't do that. But the Psalms are our instructors. They show us so many beautiful prayers where saints of old come to God and they just lay it all out. I'm struggling. I don't know what to do with this, or how could you, or why? You take it to him. Now you're in a conversation. Now you're not just venting rage aimlessly. The second thing they say is that you need to pay attention to what God might be speaking. You know, when we get angry, sometimes we close ourselves off. We stop listening. We stop communicating. But God wants to speak to you in the midst of pain and tragedy and sorrow. You know, what I've found with God is that tragedy can actually be the space where he speaks to us most powerfully. How does he speak to us? Well, through his word, as I read that, through prayer, through Christian friends who I can be vulnerable with and trust myself to, through the preaching of the word of God on Sunday mornings. That's why I need to show up and hear the word preached. He takes tragedy and he speaks to us. C.S. Lewis said it like this, pain insists upon being attended to. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pain. Here's the final point. Remember that God isn't finished with you. Bitterness likes to chirp in your ear and say that you're through. Naomi thought she was roadkill, but as we're going to follow the rest of this story, God's not done with him or with her, and he's not done with you until he calls you home. In fact, what often results from profound tragedy is newfound ministry. We have stories like this all over our church. I think of like Gary Brennan, for example, who goes through a profound accident and he has a brain injury. And let me just be clear, any one of these tragedies I'm about to tell you about, they never would have asked for that. They weren't on the lookout for it. And yet, God brought it into their world for a reason. And for Gary, it's resulted in ministry where he can go into situations where someone has a brain injury and he can walk them through. This is what's going to happen. This is what it's going to be like. This is how I found hope in the midst of it. We have veterans who have seen atrocities, been exposed to just life-threatening situations, suffered from PTSD. They've gone through the process of healing, and now they are coming alongside other wounded warriors. We have parents who have raised children with disabilities, and they've walked that road, and they've become experts on how do I love my child well, and then they extend that care to other parents. They become a blessing to them. We have others who have gone through the process of grief, and they say, you know what? I'm going to start a ministry at the church called Grief Share, and they've led people to Christ in the midst of their tragedy because the world offers no solutions for grief. But here's the truth. To get there, if you want to be a neighbor, before you can love others well, you've got to go through a process of healing yourself. Every single week, I want to challenge us towards something because I want us to be great neighbors. You got some papers there, and I'll talk about that in just a little bit. But this week, as I think about the challenge, I think there's kind of two things in response to what we've been talking about. The first thing we've got to understand is I can't live with bitterness. I shouldn't. God doesn't want me to. But emotions can be deep wells. And sometimes I'm carrying bitterness and I don't even know I am. I haven't admitted it to myself. You know, Psalm 139 is a great place to go if that may be true of you. Because David prays to God in Psalm 139, "Search me, O God. I don't know me as well as you know me, God. I need to see me the way you see me. And if I'm holding on to something that is disrupting my ability to love others, help me to see that, Lord." The second thing, part of this challenge, is I do not believe that anyone can recover from bitterness by themselves. We need others. And sometimes that's a very hard thing to accept because it was someone that hurt me that made me bitter. But I believe this principle down to the core of who I am. People can hurt us, but it takes people to heal us. So if you are struggling, find a counselor. Seek pastoral care. Entrust yourself with other believers who are trustworthy and be vulnerable. If you start applying that in your world, then you're going to be no longer a black hole, but a reflective body again. And God can use that in profound ways.